talk about today is a somewhat more theoretical study than the sorts of things that Joe was talking about in his previous, in his presentation. And I've been interested in constructing idealised sorts of models to study particularly the influence of initial conditions on the evolution of uncertainty within the atmospheric system. Now, I'm going to consider some quite idealised sorts of models, which, you know, there are reasons for criticising what I'm doing, but the basic aim is to try and get a basic theoretical understanding of what's going to be required to apply some of the information theoretical techniques in the future. A fair bit of the modelling that I'm going to present here you can find in a special issue in Physica D. That was from a workshop, actually, that I came to at IPAM 2 years ago, which was very useful. Also, I've got an extended paper in Journal of Atmospheric Science, which is under revision at the moment, which goes into a lot of detail as well. All right, so the basic perspective I'm going to use in looking at statistical predictability is a relaxation perspective. So what I'm going to assume is that you have some sort of initialization process, data assimilation process, for producing the initial conditions and also producing uncertainty in the initial conditions. And that's what the top PDF is up there. And then as time goes on, as one lets go that uncertainty within the dynamical model, the PDF relaxes, and given sufficient time, it should equilibrate to what I'm going to call the equilibrium or climatological distribution. And what I'm going to be particularly interested in figuring out is what that time scale is and what that relaxation process looks like. Okay, and the relaxation time scale is actually going to be quite a bit longer than the time scale that one normally associates with making weather forecasts. And so in some sense this study is also relevant to making climate predictions in the atmosphere as well. I'll come back to that as I go through. Now, the way that I'm going to study this relaxation process is through relative entropy. So in standard stochastic differential equation theory, such as the Chapman-Kolmogorov equation or the Fokker-Planck equation, which is a specialisation of it, one studies this relaxation process naturally through what's known as the Lyapunov functional, which is also the relative entropy. And you can prove in those systems that in fact that relaxation process is monotonic in time, okay? And that's known as the generalized second law of thermodynamics, that relaxation, the fact that that relaxation process actually is monotonic. And it also, as I've emphasized previously in the literature, you can interpret that relative entropy also as the potential utility of the statistical prediction. Because if you think of the equilibrium distribution as a prior distribution, that's a very natural way to think about the equilibrium distribution, since if one has no information about the initial conditions or the evolution of the uncertainty through the prediction model, one would assume the equilibrium distribution for a particular random variable. So that's a prior distribution, and then after going through all that process, one ends up with a prediction distribution. Then the shift in those distributions, okay, is measured by the relative entropy, but it also tells you what the utility is of actually making the prediction. Of course, all of this is hinged on the fact that I'm making a perfect model assumption, okay? Now, there are certain problems in applying this methodology to systems of large number of degrees of freedom, which have been alluded to by Andy in his talk on Monday and also by Joe in the previous talk. And I'm going to adopt a particular technique for doing that, which amounts to an approximation for that relative entropy. Okay? I'm going to use two different ways of doing that and cross-check them against against each other. Okay, but there just fairly obviously there is a very big problem associated with the large number of degrees of freedom in a realistic dynamical system. I'm going to try and address that in a simple-minded kind of approach. All right, oops. It's actually quite useful to consider the case in which the PDFs are Gaussian. Why is that? Well, because in many of the systems with large numbers of degrees of freedom, it turns out, probably because of the central limit theorem, that a lot of the dynamical variables are distributed according to distributions that are fairly close to Gaussian. Okay, so it's a useful approximation for looking at the full distribution. Okay, now, you can compute the relative entropy for a Gaussian distribution exactly, and that's of use as well, and it consists of two parts, which I'm going to emphasise. The first part, which I'm going to call a dispersion, really only depends on the covariance matrix of both the equilibrium and the prediction distribution. Okay? Whereas the second part depends on the difference of the means of the two distributions, normalised by the covariance matrix for the equilibrium distribution. Okay, so it's sort of thinking about it crudely. The first bit is like the spread of the ensemble, or it's proportional to the spread of the ensemble. I'm talking very loosely here. Whereas the second part is like something like measuring the sum of the squares of the anomalies, normalised by the variance of the particular EOF that you're considering. We'll come to that in a minute. So that's the split up for the relative entropy in the case of Gaussian distributions. And it's interesting that it's related in some sort of vague way to common skill measures that are used to evaluate predictions. So if I go ahead, make the perfect model assumption, and then compute what the RMS error would be and what the anomaly correlation would be. They're the two most common skill measures. I get those two expressions there. And you can see the over bar there means it's an ensemble. It's averaging over a series of ensembles. The relative entropy is only with respect to one ensemble. But notice how the RMS error only depends on the spread, okay, of the ensemble, whereas the anomaly correlation depends on both the spread and the anomalies, the difference between the prediction and the climatological distributions. Okay, so in some sense, the relative entropy is banging those two perfect model skill measures together. Okay, and I like to use it because it has the natural dynamical interpretation that I went through before, but you can sort of relate it to commonly used skill measures as well, which is attractive as well. Okay, so now let's go on to the model I'm going to use. I'm going to use a relatively realistic model because I've used a hierarchy of models previously, and I've found that the results can be quite dependent on the particular member of the increasing complexity hierarchy of models. So I'm trying to go to a model in which, you know, I have some confidence that the basic dynamical mechanisms are being properly simulated. So this model is a Hill-Suarez type core, dynamical core, in which I relax towards a particular temperature profile, Newtonian cooling. That relaxation temperature profile looks like a moist adiabat in the equatorial region, but it becomes more unstable as I go to higher latitudes. So it's kind of simulating the effects of radiation and convection, and I'm junking those within this model because I'm going to use very large ensembles, so I have to save computational expense some way, and I'm saving computational expense by simplifying the physics within the model. And the particular configuration I'm going to look at is from the northern winter, okay? So that's reflected in that Newtonian cooling profile. And if one looks at the zonally averaged zonal velocity at 300 millibars, the jet stream, you get a jet stream which is perhaps a little bit too strong at about 30 degrees north in the winter hemisphere, and you get a reasonable one in the southern hemisphere, in the summer hemisphere. Also, if you look near the surface at the zonal velocity variance, you see that it picks out the storm track regions reasonably well. And the reason it's doing that is because, I forgot to mention that, this model also incorporates realistic orography at the surface. So the zonal variation in the jet is able to steer the eddies within the model. Okay, so in a number of respects, this is a fairly realistic sort of model. Now, I initialised the model and produced ensembles using a very crude, very simplistic data assimilation strategy. And that's one way in which you can criticise these results is because of this very simplified data assimilation strategy. So I used an isotropic Gaussian distribution with a 1,000-kilometre horizontal decorrelation scale, and it had no correlation vertically or between the prognostic variables. And I chose variances, the uncertainty variances in that data assimilation, to be two orders of magnitude smaller than the equilibrium values.
What was the thinking behind not having vertical correlation?
It's just simplification. I need to check that to see what the sensitivity is, but there are a lot of things I need to check to test sensitivity. It's just the first cut.
It's easy to do it layer by layer.
Okay, so that's the model configuration.
So Richard, the spatially correlated noise, that is the initial conditions for the ensemble?
Yes.
Or it's added on top of some other...
No, what I do is I specify that as the probability, the PDF for the initial conditions, and then I sample from it, okay, to generate the ensemble.
So it's perturbed around the climatological...
Yes. That's a good point. What I do is I take a very long climatological run, then I take a snapshot, and I use that as the mean for this distribution. And then I use a spread. And also, to make sure that the ensemble predictions are balanced, I use a Lynch gravity wave filter to get rid of gravity waves in the ensemble.
So I assume it's not an accident. You picked 1,000-kilometer decorrelation time with the equatorial, with the mid latitude Rossby radius.
It's obviously too crude. I need to go back and do a proper ensemble counting filter or something like that to do this job properly. But that's for a further study.
But it seems like ensemble prediction suffers from the same problem as the rest of our field in terms of deciding what model to use to make our points.
It's
always a question.
Yeah, you make judicious choices and then you get criticised. So that's life. So now the methodology, the ensemble methodology. As has been pointed out by Andy and by Joe in his talk before, there's a severe problem here because this dynamical system is a very large dimensionality. So I have to do something. If I'm going to compute entropy-like things, I've got to do something to reduce that dimensionality. And the methodology that I use is looking at EOFs. And the EOFs are of the prognostic variables from this model. So they're of temperature, vorticity, divergence, and surface pressure. Okay, at five vertical levels. I should have said this model has got five vertical levels. So then I compute from a climatological run the first 150 or so EOFs and figure out how much of the variance those EOFs explain. And it turns out, this is consistent with what Joe was saying, that in this model, which is T42, so it's considerably simpler than state-of-the-art operational weather forecasting models. If you get to about 60 of those EOFs, then you can capture about 90% of the total variance. Yes?
So
What does VOF stand for?
Empirical orthogonal function. So
okay.
it's the eigenvalues of the covariance matrix.
Okay.
Now that EOF space, I'm going to show some regional calculations as well. That EOF space is different for each regional calculation. Now, when I've been doing climate forecasting prediction studies in the past, it's turned out that the EOF variance convergence is a lot faster. So in effect, climate systems like El Nino, for example, are effectively much lower dimensionality than the weather system. So for example, if I was doing this with SST, in the ENSO case, I would only probably need 5 EOFs to explain about 90% of the variance. So the atmospheric system has got a much slower roll-off than the climate system. And I have to deal with that in this system. Now, the way I do that is there's a basic problem with using a 60-dimensional system, okay? In that if you use a practical ensemble, you're not going to effectively sample the whole of that 60-dimensional space, not with a practical ensemble, okay? On the other hand, what you are able to sample are marginal distributions associated with that full 60-dimensional probability distribution. So the approach I'm going to take is to calculate the average entropy associated with each of those marginal distributions, and I'm going to increase the marginality, the dimensionality of that marginal distribution.
What's a marginal distribution?
Marginal distribution is if I've got a 60-dimensional system and then I want a marginal distribution of one dimension, I average over the other 59, I integrate over the other 59. So I get a distribution with respect to that one variable. So it's a one-dimensional distribution. And then you can consider two-dimensional systems, you integrate over the 58 variables and so on up the chain. Okay, so, and that's really what an ensemble, in my view, is actually telling you. Actually, it's telling you information about those marginal distributions. And when you get to the full 60-dimensional space, the sampling's just inadequate in resolving the whole system. It's called the curse of dimensionality. Okay, so...
Richard, the original sort of theoretical motivation for looking at relative entropy, I mean, the nice properties of it are really dependent on the full PDF, right? They don't carry over to the evolution of marginal PDFs.
No, they don't. So what I'm doing here is I'm studying an approximation of it in order to study the relaxation process.
But what we have is a theory, you weren't here Monday, but in all of our old work, we have a theory of bounds, that you can bound the relative entropy under the circumstances by using judicious sums and products of marginals projected. So it gives you good estimates of how much uncertainty there is.
There's actually a chain up to the full entropy. This is the idea of Andy's.
We have a whole theory, and that's what we use in the
data. So in this case, I'm using a very straightforward.
An example would be there's actually I mentioned this Monday in my talk. Gave some examples in ensemble prediction, but the idea basically is you can use various judiciously projected marginals to give you a good bound for the uncertainty.
Yeah, I'm just about to get on.
But let me understand. You're saying that you can get information about the 60-dimensional.
What I'm going to define is a marginal.
Two-dimensional marginal 60 times.
So what that is the average relative entropy of all the possible marginal distributions of a given order. Okay, so that's the definition there, and you see the combinatorial symbol up at the front there. So I'm averaging over all possible marginal configurations.
There's a stick behind you if you find it useful.
So that's what this one on CNM is here. It's a combinatorial thing. And one can show for a given partitioning a state space that there's this natural hierarchy of these marginal relative entropies. And at the top of the chain is the relative entropy, the full relative entropy. But the reality is that if one's using a practical ensemble in the full space, one only gets a certain distance up that hierarchy. One's fundamentally limited by that ensemble, finite ensemble size problem. Okay, so I'm going to compute these things up here. Also, what I did was I went in and I had a look at the marginal distributions, and what I found was that, and what I did was a standard statistical test to see whether I could reject the null hypothesis that they came from a Gaussian distribution. And it turned out that very rarely could I reject that null hypothesis. And the reason for that is because these ensembles look, at the marginal level, very Gaussian. Okay, so another assumption to back up this kind of approach here was I assumed that the full distribution was Gaussian and computed the relative entropy on that basis. Now, the result that you get then is much larger because one's making an assumption about the full PDF. Whereas in calculating these things here, I'm coarse-grained. I'm coarse-grained quite heavily because my sample size is so small. But a really curious result, which I don't understand, I think I got some ideas from your paper on this, is that it turns out, we'll see in a minute, that the Gaussian relative entropy is n times one of these things here, where n is the dimensionality of the space, to a very good approximation. Why that should be, I don't really understand. It's an interesting result. So, what happens when I compute this? What's the relaxation process that I was talking about look like? So, this is just a particular configuration, and I'm using a 10,000 member ensemble here, so I'm using an enormous ensemble compared to what's typically done in a practical context, and I have to, in order to get anywhere reasonable up that chain of marginal relative entropies. And so this, and I've also plotted on this graph here the Gaussian relative entropy divided by n, where n is 60. Okay? And you'll notice that you can hardly see the Gaussian. The Gaussian is sitting in these marginals. And this is the one-dimensional marginal, two-dimensional marginal, three-dimensional marginal, four-dimensional marginal. And it's respecting that hierarchy. Okay. Also, thing is, this is a very robust result. What you see is that there's almost a quasi-linear drop-off in the relative entropy down to about 45 days.
Is this in your four-dimensional ELF subspace or your one-dimensional?
I plotted them all there.
Ah.
So Richard, are the curves supposed to be ordered?
Yes.
From color? But they're misordered at the beginning.
They're misordered. There's an interesting reason for that, because for the lower order systems, for the low order marginals, you can coarse grain at a finer scale, okay? And that's most noticeable when the prediction distribution is a lot further away from the equilibrium distribution, and that's why it reorders down at that end. You notice that the Gaussian one shoots right up because it's able to resolve what's happening at those very fine scales near the initial conditions.
Monotonicity is only for the full distribution, not for these, for the...
There's some degree of non-monotonicity there.
Yeah. Is that the effect of looking at a marginal?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
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 It
could be sampling too, actually, because you'll notice that this thing actually doesn't go off to zero exactly, and that's a sampling error. That's the sampling error at the end. Okay, so yeah, you're right, it could be due to sampling. But now this result here is extremely robust. So I've in this particular case here, I've used used the prognostic variables from the primitive equation model to calculate it. But I also did it for the stream function, which is a much smoother variable, and it's virtually indistinguishable from this curve here, which I was quite surprised at. I tested the sensitivity of that EOF truncation space, so it's 60 dimensional. I increased it to 100, reduced it to 40. There's not much sensitivity of that curve, so it's fairly robust from that point of view. Also, I'm using a T42 model. I went to a T85 model, so I doubled the resolution both meridianally and zonally, and I was very surprised that it did not make a lot of difference. Very surprised. I was expecting that those extra small scales of variability would have some effect, but it doesn't look as if beyond T42 it makes a lot of difference. It seems to approximately converged this sort of behaviour. And notice that after about 50 days, you're down to about zero. And that's got a nice interpretation from the point of view of climate prediction, because one thing that's often considered in making climate predictions in the atmosphere, when you do that, you have two choices about inserting information into those predictions. You can do it through the initial conditions, and you can do it through the boundary conditions. The predictability of the first kind, predictability of the second kind. What this is saying is that predictability of the first kind is gone by about a month and a half. And it's a robust result. So I think that's a useful result from the point of view of making atmospheric climate predictions, potentially, okay, given the limitations of the approach that I've talked about. Okay, so it's an interesting, robust result.
If I understand correctly, you said the information from the initial data is basically gone after 50 days.
Yes.
Why does that say so much about climate prediction?
Because beyond that, beyond 50 days, the only way you're going to make a prediction about the state of the atmosphere, a probabilistic prediction about the state of the atmosphere, is through the boundary conditions, through SST, rather than through the initial conditions.
Tell me if this interpretation would be correct as well. If, say, you have a model which has biases, so
yeah.
You initialize the model with some realistic state, and you're going to see the model biases appear. Is it fair to say that you would see these model biases appear in the first 50 days? You don't have to run a long time to see model biases, or is that taking it too far?
I'm not sure.
Here's the first thing you do. You take the climate. So if you could run both models, they're easy models, run them for a long time, you'd look at the error using relative entropy of one climatology versus the other, because you know from Richard's theorem, the theorem about Fokker-Planck equations, if you ran either dynamical system independently, any distribution would ultimately adjust to the equilibrium. So you need to know the relative entropy of how much lack of information is in your model's error compared to your truth in the climatology.
Well, that's, of course, the model error series that we should affect the error growth.
Absolutely, yeah. And I'm not considering that.
No, but that would be the first thing. That would be the first thing you could do. And you'll see some examples of that in data assimilation later on today.
Okay, so then I looked at, the regional variation in this predictability, which is interesting. So this is the North Pacific storm track region. This is the North Atlantic storm track region. This is the Southern Ocean storm track region. And remember, this is a winter hemisphere, and that's the summer hemisphere. And there's quite, between the North Pacific and the North Atlantic, there's virtually no difference, which is interesting. It's got the same predictability characteristic. Yes?
I wonder, how different it is, you have 45 to 50 days from the correlation of the particular EOF that you're looking for?
The EOFs?
Yeah, you're looking for, like 60 first moments of
yeah.
The EOF.
I'll come to that in a minute.
Okay.
So So these look indistinguishable. I mean, there's a bit of jumpiness now, notice, and I think that's associated with information flow from one part of the system to the other part of the system. That's why these aren't monotonic so much. The southern ocean, the time scale is much longer for some reason. I don't understand that result yet, but I strongly suspect it's due to the fact that the vertical shear in the mean state is much higher in this case than it is in that case. I think it's a basic instability property of the storm tracks. Okay, so
did you flip the winter to the south and try again?
No, I haven't done that yet. I need to do that.
Gotcha.
Yeah, too many things. I also looked at the Gaussian, compared the Gaussian and the marginal entropies. And what I did was I constructed a whole series of initial conditions, a whole series of means. Okay, but what I was showing you before was only one particular set of initial conditions. So now what I did was I constructed 50 different initial conditions and looked at the correlation between the Gaussian and the marginal relative entropies. And the correlation between the marginal entropies themselves is extremely high between those initial conditions. And the correlation with the Gaussian relative entropies maybe 0.8, 0.9, which I sort of interpret as there being some non-Gaussianicity within the system, but not very much. Now, if you split...
One has to be very careful with that ensemble size. So your ensemble size is what?
In this case, it's 1,000, whereas previously it was 10,000.
Even with your... So with your 60-dimensional space, there's a real issue. Because you can fake it even with 1,000 ensembles and have a Gaussian distribution. You have to do the blind test of a Gaussian distribution you draw from in a 60-dimensional
case.
No,
that's fair. I'm just flipping up results, you're right.
Yeah.
Now, you can split the Gaussian relative entropy up into the signal part and the dispersion part. And ask yourself the question, what causes variations in predictability? Is it variations in anomalies, the sum of the squares of the anomalies, or is it variations in ensemble spread? Okay, and the correlation between the signal term, the anomaly squared divided by the variance of the EOF, is much more highly correlated with the marginal relative entropies and the full Gaussian relative entropy as well, than is the dispersion. So this is saying that the major control over Gaussian relative entropy here is the signal and not the dispersion. Okay, and that runs counter to certain arguments about ensemble skill spread relationships that are often discussed in the numerical weather prediction literature. I also started having a look at what these things actually mean by going back into the EOF space, and I got some interesting results. So what I did was I had a look and I found that the signal did not show any much preference for any particular EOF. Okay, there was not the particular signal that was seen in the system didn't have anything to do with any particular EOF. It could occur right throughout the whole spectrum. So it looks like some sort of generic anomaly within the system. Okay. The other thing that was interesting was that then I did a lag correlation of the signal in time, and it shows this very rapid fall off. So the signal actually decays within the system with a time scale of about 2 to 3 days. Very short time scale. So you might have a very skillful system, but then 2 or 3 days later, it's gone. Okay, it's a very rapid roll-off. And that sort of behavior is very different to the climate case, the El Nino case, where the decorrelation time scale is much slower. Okay, and this is true of both the dispersion and the signal. They roll off fairly rapidly. The dispersion tends to roll off slightly slower than the signal, for some reason. I don't quite understand that. And the other thing is that as time goes on, it looks as if the decorrelation time is increasing as one goes deeper into the prediction.
And that must have something to do with the information flow from the unresolved modes, which are the smaller scale events that,
I think there's also some sort of training of the modes going on with time, okay, as well. I'm not sure that I understand that yet. But, okay, so now for the second part of the talk, I decided to look at the effect, to be adventurous and start to look at the effect of the MJO on that mid-latitude predictability. And the reason I did that was because there was a very nice study recently published by Lynn Kalatis and co-workers looking at the nature of the MJO in a range of different climate models, actually, which were used in the IPCC report. Okay, and they find that really, to be quite frank, the MJO is not very well simulated in those models at all. Now the MJO, you can see, this is a spectrum of the MJO here, is quite a coherent signal with a particular periodicity.
So black is the observation.
So black, there's two observational estimates here, a solid black line this is the spectrum at a particular point, and this is a longitudinal section of the variance. Okay. And in all cases, you can see that the models grossly underestimate the variance of the MJO, and their spectrum is screwy in one way or another. And my understanding in talking to some of these authors is that this is also true in numerical weather prediction models, not just in climate models. So if there's this quasi-regular phenomenon within the tropical atmosphere, which is being poorly simulated, okay, it has a potential effect on predictability in the middle latitudes because the MJO can fairly effectively teleconnect with the middle latitudes. So I decided to have a look at that effect. So I built myself a very simple stochastic model of the MJO. So the particular stochastic model, I built a stochastic model of the MJO heating, diabatic heating. What I did was I looked at the outgoing long wave radiation EOFs and I bandpassed them to isolate the MJO. And the first two of those EOFs show a strong temporal decorrelation pattern, and they're normally called the MJO. So I defined them as the MJO. And then what I did was I associated each of those spatial patterns with the components of a damped stochastic oscillator. Okay? So the stochastic oscillator, because of its particular formulation, shows propagation between those two spatial patterns as time goes on. Okay? And because there's stochastic forcing in here, I can reproduce the observed spectrum of the MJO as well. Okay? I don't really have enough time to go into this in a lot of detail. I use Arkin's formula to back out the diabatic heating, so I'd keep it at a realistic level. I inserted it in the primitive equation model that I just described. And then I did two experiments to test what the effect of having a bad model of the MJO would have on predictability. In the first case, I initialized this statistical model with a fixed relationship between these two EOFs for all ensemble members. And in the second experiment, I chose them at random from a long run of the stochastic oscillator. So that simulates in a fairly gross way what would happen if you initialize the numerical weather prediction model with a lousy MJO in it. Within a very short period of time, you lose it, within the system. Okay, so now I compared those two cases and what the effect on mid-latitude predictability would be. And here's what the statistical model of the NGO, what its behaviour is. It looks quite reasonable. I believe that Matt Wheeler's built a similar model to this to make NGO predictions in real time. So this is band passed observations of outgoing long wave radiation for the first EOF. It's got this kind of structure, right? Spectral peak. This is what the stochastic model looks like. Also, if you do temporal decorrelation of the two EOFs, they have this kind of oscillatory behaviour, and the stochastic model is reproducing that as well. Okay, so it seems to be, at least as far as the first two EOFs, it seems to be behaving fairly realistically compared to the observations. And this is what those two EOFs look like. So the typical evolution is EOF1 to minus EOF2. So this red blob here becomes this big red blob here, reversing the sign. So you get the blobs moving across in an eastward fashion. Okay, so then I did the same. This is what I call the MJO potential predictability effect. I looked at the two cases, one in which I didn't have any information about the initialisation of the MJO, and one in which I had perfect information about the initialisation of the MJO. And I saw a very large effect in the North Pacific, larger in the North Pacific than in the North Atlantic, which is kind of what you would expect because the MJO's centre of action is in the Western Pacific, so this is more remote. Okay, but you'll notice the substantial change in the prediction curve there. There seems to be an effect. Now, I'm not saying that that you can criticise the experiment that I've just set up, okay? But the main point is that there is a big effect. There appears to be a big effect on predictability.
Richard, this is an experiment where the model is fixed, but you're comparing two different sort of initial ways of constructing the ensemble.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
So it's not really saying what happens when you put... If you had lots of observations, you could observe the MJO in its present state, but then you put that into a model.
You put it in the model, then the model loses it very quickly if it's a bad model. So that's what I'm crudely simulating.
Well, it may not if you do the right targeted observations. That's the issue. Are you sure?
Well, that's a hypothesis.
No, but he's saying if it's a bad model, right?
If it's a bad model, I don't
how
think
quickly will
you, you whack in all of that data of the MJO into a really bad model. It's going to lose it pretty quickly. That's my impression.
That's this time scale?
Sorry?
That's this
time scale. The time scale, yeah, this is one day here.
Because this comes, that goes back to that question I was asking before. You can use this to tell your, so a lot of people now are trying to isolate model biases by running the model in forecast mode.
Right.
And the hypothesis there is that you can see the biases emerge quite quickly. So you give the model a well-observed state, and then you run it a few time steps, a few days, and you already see the model biases being apparent. And this seems to me to be a variant of that same sort of, it's telling the same thing, that the model establishes its biases and goes to its climatology pretty quick.
It does, yeah. It's interesting actually how fast that happens, that change happens. It's useful for
trying to understand model error because it says you can work in that short time frame quite fruitfully.
I'm confused, Bjorn. I mean, this experiment was, the model is not changing here, so how does this tell us anything about model error?
Well, the MJO component of it is in the second experiment I'm simulating the effect of having a very lousy MJO.
But there you're not initializing the MJO, but the model is still the same as...
Yeah.
But it's the extratropical model, not the convective. These are surrogates for a bad convective parameterization or good convective parameterization in the tropics.
That's
and
not.
His extratropical model is the same.
I don't want to defend the setup too much. Okay, this is just a first cut at the problem to see whether there's going to be an effect. I mean, these are preliminary results. I've got my graduate student working hard on this at the moment, to set up more realistic configurations which better simulate the effect of having a lousy MGO.
Are you sure they're working on it right now?
No, I'm not.
Uncertainty of prediction.
Okay, so that's it.